Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 7th, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Dhammanu Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches what it means to be one with a sense of the Dhamma. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So this sutta is called the Dhammanu Sutta. This subtitle is One with a Sense of the Dhamma, similar to Saturday's sutta, the Dhamma Viharan Sutta, one who dwells in the Dhamma. I think that's what it was. And so this sutta is about what it looks like to live a life integrated with the Eightfold Path, what it feels like. And it's also how we all can know if we're actually developing a Dhamma the way the Buddha teaches a Dhamma, which is a very simple and direct practice. And you can almost read in many of these suttas, not just this one, that even during the Buddha's time, listening to an awakened human being teach his Dhamma, there was still an inclination or even a motivation to adapt and accommodate or embellish what this awakened human being taught. And so a lot of his teachings is just how to stay focused on what he's teaching and not be distracted, which is a common problem of a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So there's an introduction that I won't read, because basically this is what I just said. On one occasion, the Buddha addressed those gathered. A disciple who is worthy of support and recognition has these seven qualities. They are one with a sense of the Dhamma. And a sense of the Dhamma means you understand the Dhamma. They are one with a sense of meaning. Again, meaning of the Dhamma. What does the Dhamma mean? What's the purpose? They are one with a sense of themselves. That directly speaks to one of the three marks of existence of anatta, doesn't it? We no longer are ignorant of who and what we are. We have a sense of who we are. And that sense was developed through having a sense of the Dhamma and a meaning of the Dhamma. They are one with a sense of moderation. You know how much time the Buddha taught and I spend teaching restraint or moderation, because it's a lack of restraint and immoderate living that keeps us entangled in the world, doesn't it? So again, this is a direct teachings on how to develop and what a Dhamma practice looks like and what it feels like. They are one with a sense of time, which that one little line, I mean, boy, it covers everything, doesn't it? It speaks to impermanence. It speaks to understanding, the understanding that Bahia got, you know, with the cow that got him right after he talked to the Buddha. We don't know when the end is coming. We don't know when we're going to lose the opportunity to awaken in this lifetime. And then it speaks to the impermanence of all things, doesn't it? So again, this, you know, I was going to say this little sutta. It's not such a little sutta. There's a lot in it. But it speaks again to the heart of the Dhamma, and it speaks to understanding the three marks of existence. They are one with a sense of social groups. We talk a lot about that, and that there's an underlying theme throughout the Buddha's Dhamma is to be mindful of who and what we're associating with, because who and what we're associating with determines our life experience. And then with something as singularly important as the Dhamma, to associate with people in our Dhamma practice that are actually developing the Dhamma. And again, the Buddha's teaching this because there was a common distraction during the Buddha's time to practice anything and everything that had a spiritual label on it. Number seven, they are one with a sense of the distinction of individuals. And those that have read this know that last part is probably the most involved part of the sutta. We may not get to it tonight. This might be a two or three part teaching, but we'll see how it goes. The Buddha continues. A disciple who is one with a sense of the Dhamma understands the dialogues and the narratives of prose and verse, the spontaneous exclamations and quotations, the stories of birth and amazing events, and the question and answer sessions. If they don't understand the Dhamma in this way, they are not one with the Dhamma. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of the Dhamma. So we simply understand. We've spent some time listening to the Dhamma. In this case, they have listened to the Buddha talking in a formal way about the Dhamma, formal teachings, his spontaneous utterings that had to do with, in suttas, it had to do with situational events, the stories of amazing events, but put in context, that there's nothing all that amazing, is there? As far as the Dhamma is concerned, there's only ignorance and there's only wisdom. And then one who understands the questions and answers that have been put out there. Because it's just as important to understand, as you're developing the Dhamma, to have developed questions about the Dhamma, but also to have gotten the answers and have become mindful of the answers and not just discarded them. The Buddha is speaking here about penetrating a mind that is rooted in ignorance. A mind rooted in ignorance may ask questions, but because they're inclined to continue to ignore ignorance, will already have the answer in their mind. And so they may not accept an answer from an awakened human being.
Okay. I find the that first part there about the stories and the amazing events.
The stories of birth and amazing events?
Yeah. That's the part, of, at least those stories and of the birth and amazing events, they are in the suttas.
Oh, yeah.
Some of those I find a little hard to take.
Me too.
And I also know that in later, even a couple of hundred years later, there's this travelogue that the Chinese monks would come to get, you know, copies of the Dhamma. And what you see then, what is then current Buddhism, is all about, like, the so-called miracles that the Buddha had performed, and, you know, amazing stories about his birth and all that kind of stuff. So I'm having a little bit of a hard time separating those two things.
No, I understand
what,
that.
Yeah, what he, you know, which one of those stories are actual, you know, we find now in the Sutta Pitaka are what he told. And I'm suspicious that a lot of that stuff was added later as, you know, to feed this need for miracle stories.
It's just as different translators will come to different conclusions about the meaning of the Dhamma, about what, you know, what the original texts are saying. So too does even individual events like that, like amazing events and birth stories. So in here, the Buddha's not separating them out as anything special. And in the suttas, he teaches that there's nothing special about understanding births or future lives or these amazing events. The Jataka Tales, which is a set of books that are about the Buddha's thousands of past lives and some of the major characters, to me that's all speculation, but some people will say, oh, these are all based on truth. But you remember when the Buddha, we went through this series of talks about how he addressed Vacchagoda and Anuruddha, etc. And in those suttas and in many others, he said that being distracted towards what you were in the past or what you might be in the future is simply that. It's a distraction rooted in ignorance. So in this, when you understand the reference in context, the Buddha is saying, these are things that people concern themselves with, think about. Don't get distracted by them. Because what's important is the Four Noble Truths and the Three Marks of Existence. What's important is the Eightfold Path. Recognizing your own ignorance in relation to what's occurring in your life. And in that way, past lives, future lives, amazing events, miracles have no bearing at all. But they need to be addressed because they were a common preoccupation during the Buddha's time, just as they are today. And so to not mention them, you know, you have to be careful. You know, when you read the Buddha, he's very careful how he addresses these, to not overemphasize them and create a dharma where people are seeking to figure out what they were in the past that will describe who they might be in the future. Or get preoccupied with doing certain rituals right now, so in the future I'll have a more pleasant birth. I mean, that's often how merit is portrayed in modern Buddhism. So, but in context, past lives, future lives, amazing events are just something that are unfolding in time and in conversation. There's no real benefit to it. Does that help clarify it? Mm-hmm. It's something that I had to, it took me a while to figure that one out too, because I came from one tradition that put a great emphasis on what you might be in the future and a great emphasis on understanding clearly, just like you're sitting right here, understanding each and every one of your past lives. In fact, that was emphasized over anything else in this particular Tibetan tradition. That's how you know you're awakened, when you know all of your past lives. Pardon me?
How do you know if you know all of them?
Well, again, it seems like speculation, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, in a past life, I was always Joe DiMaggio. Go back. It was never you know, a carpenter or a meditation teacher. It was. So even if you could be sure of that, even if I could tell you right now, in fact, I could. I've had experiences, direct, visceral experiences of who I was in certain times in past lives. So what? What does it mean? Even if it's true, it was explained to me why I'm averse to being a monk in this life, because I lived a long time as a monk in seclusion, like, you know, 40 years. Okay, so what? I mean, even if it's true, so what?
What does it do for you?
I don't think it did anything for me, even if it's true. Again, so it could be just a distraction, but I could take on the air, using that as an example. Well, I've been a monk for so many lives. Look at me. I mean, it could be anything that we do, you know. So, in context, past lives, future lives, amazing events, they really don't matter. What does the Buddha teach? This is suffering, this is the nature of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering. And he repeatedly said that over and over again when people would bring up these great questions. And so, you know, maybe the snide answer was, if you want to know about past lives, this ain't the place. You know, go someplace else. Because it's not important. Is that clear, though? Because we can get so caught up in the mystical aspects of that. And again, even if there was some way of actually knowing. And one of these days I'm going to teach a sutta that is similar to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where the Buddha gets into a little bit more detail about aspects of mindfulness in relation to past lives. But he addresses it in the same way, that it's inconsequential. No. Let's get back to the sutta. Great question, thank you. That was one of the reasons why I think we might not get through this whole thing. This is important. This is what this sutta brings us up. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of the Dhamma. I'm going to skip over my commentary within the sutta. The Buddha continues, a disciple who is one with a sense of meaning understands the context and the purpose of the Dhamma. If a disciple does not understand the context and purpose of the Dhamma, they would not be one with a sense of meaning. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of the meaning of the Dhamma. And so again, in order to live a life within the framework of the Eightfold Path, we have to understand the context and purpose of the Dhamma, don't we? This part of the sutta is just saying, be focused on what I teach and do not get involved in what I don't teach. Understand the meaning and the purpose of this. Why am I teaching this? I'm teaching the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering. Nothing more. Those are the Buddha's words. I'm teaching to gain profound insight into three marks of existence. The Buddha continues, a disciple who is one with a sense of themselves knows the development of conviction. They know their development of virtue They know their development of the Dhamma, and they are able to spontaneously express the Dhamma. A disciple that does not know the development of conviction, that does not know the development of virtue, that does not know the development of the Dhamma, and they are not capable of spontaneously expressing the Dhamma, this disciple is not one with a sense of themselves. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of them, one with a sense of the Dhamma, a sense of the meaning of the Dhamma, and one with a sense of themselves. So now the Buddha is taking us and putting us right in the middle of the Dhamma. One who has no sense of the Dhamma, who has never heard the Dhamma, never developed a meditation practice within the framework of the Eightfold Path, is still one who is stuck in wrong views of themselves. As we start developing the Dhamma and develop a sense in the meaning of the Dhamma, we develop an understanding of how we relate as individuals. And this is such an important point. It speaks to the misunderstanding that there's no such thing as a self. Again, think about the time that the Buddha is teaching to develop an understanding of what a self is. And he certainly wouldn't come to the end of that and say, guess what, I'm just kidding, there's no such thing as a self. He's teaching us very clearly to understand what a self is. And what is that self in relation to the meaning and purpose of the Dhamma? It's someone who is continually in a process of becoming, rooted in wisdom of Four Noble Truths. It's a person who is rooted in or developing right view. And how does the Buddha describe right view? Right view is a view that understands at a profound level the nature of stress and suffering. It is a mind that is resting in equanimity. Any questions? Yeah, we're getting through this pretty quick. A disciple who is one with a sense of moderation knows moderation in accepting food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. A disciple who is not one with a sense of moderation is not moderate in accepting food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of the Dhamma, one with a sense of the meaning of the Dhamma, and one with a sense of themselves, and one with a sense of moderation. That this last section is another key to developing understanding, isn't it? Moderation is another word for practicing restraint at the senses. Instead of continually grasping over what is mine and what I need more of, or having a mind of aversion that I need to avoid anything that might take away from my pleasure, moderation leaves that mind at peace, isn't it? Because we take only what we need and we leave the rest. A sense of moderation in all things, not just, the basics are food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. But if we practice restraint within the Dhamma, then we'll stop or avoid the compulsive need to add to something that doesn't need anything added to it. We'll cease trying to embellish it in any way and maintain our focus. Is that clear? The Buddha continues, a disciple who is one with a sense of time knows when it is time for recitation, when it is time for questioning, when it is time for meditation, when it is time for seclusion. A disciple who is not one with time does not know when it is time for recitation or questioning or meditation or seclusion. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of the Dhamma, one with a sense of the meaning of the Dhamma, one with a sense of themselves, one with a sense of moderation, and one with a sense of time. So what this, again, this is a broadly encompassing topic. But then as far as the practicing the Dhamma is concerned, a sense of time means, in a very practical way, now it's the time to meditate, first and foremost. Now is a time to learn more about the Eightfold Path or study more about it. Now is a time to go to class, go to Sangha. And then in a slightly broader way, to know when it's time to discuss the Dhamma, when it is time to talk about the Dhamma with others, and when it's time to keep our mouths shut. It's just not the right time. A sense of time is very similar to having a sense of yourself and understanding the entire context of the Dhamma. Is that clear? Because that can be pretty ambiguous. A sense of time is again, it's a key to the Dhamma. resting in meditation, but also in developing the entire Eightfold Path. Knowing in which situations an aspect of the Eightfold Path might be applicable. That's knowing a sense of time.
Well, and also not being in the past or the future.
Yes.
Right?
So yes. Very good point.
I mean,
being
it's
present.
Simple, but
yeah. And also knowing that.
Where you are.
Yeah, when you're stuck in the past or stuck in the future, having a sense of time will recognize that. Take a breath, come back into what's occurring. The essence of mindfulness. Thank you. A disciple who is one with a sense of social gatherings knows warriors and Brahmins and householders and contemplatives. They know how to address them and act appropriately. A disciple who is not one with a sense of social gatherings does not know warriors and Brahmins and householders and contemplatives, and they do not know how to address them or act appropriately. That list is just, you know, they don't know everyone. They don't know that, they don't know that, this gets to a little bit later in the sutta, they don't know the distinctions between people. A disciple knowing the Dhamma in this way can be known as a disciple who is one with a sense of the Dhamma, one with a sense of the meaning of the Dhamma, one with a sense of themselves, one with a sense of moderation, one with a sense of time, and one with a sense of social gatherings. Excuse me. Again, this comes back to your appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds, depending on who and what you're associated with. And so sometimes it's an appropriate time to talk about the Dhamma, and sometimes it's just appropriate to keep your mouth shut. And then as we develop the Dhamma, we'll know, as the Buddha referred to earlier, what is an appropriate spontaneous utterance about the Dhamma. Because remember, this is not just something in isolation. We have developed a sense of the Dhamma, a sense of ourselves, a sense of the meaning and purpose of the Dhamma. And so in social gatherings, we'll know when it's appropriate to say something or not. And also it leads, when we've developed a Dhamma in this way, we'll be mindful of the social gatherings that we're a part of. And sometimes we might decide this is inappropriate for me to be part of this association. Sometimes it won't, but that's an important part of the Dhamma. Again, it's an underlying theme that the Buddha talks about a lot.
But it also restates that we're living in the phenomenal world.
Yeah. And there's all types of different situations and social gatherings, et cetera. Should we continue?
Because
we're getting... Okay. Everybody's good with where we're at?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because if we continue, we're probably going to finish. A disciple who is one with a sense of the distinctions of individuals knows two categories of people: those who dismiss noble ones and those that acknowledge noble ones. They disapprove of those that dismiss noble ones and praise those that acknowledge noble ones. Again, in the context of the Dhamma, we're not talking about dissing people. Oh, they don't know noble ones. Within the framework of the Dhamma, and talking about Dhamma practitioners and people that aren't. We simply know the difference. We know the distinction between one who practices a Dhamma and one who doesn't. And so within the Sangha, we praise those that actually practice a Dhamma, that have developed a Dhamma. It doesn't mean that we kick people in the butts that don't. Furthermore, there are two categories of people who acknowledge noble ones. There are those that acknowledge noble ones and want to hear the true Dhamma, and those that want a false Dhamma. One with a sense of distinctions of individuals disapproves of those wanting false Dhammas and praise those wanting true Dhammas. Again, something common today, just as common during the Buddhist time. Someone might acknowledge, well, there's an awakened human being. Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, is a good one, an example of this. They know the Buddha, they know he's an awakened one, yet they want something different than the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha's referring to. Devadatta was a Buddha's cousin who tried to kill the Buddha twice because he wanted the power that the Buddha had. Furthermore, there are two categories of people who want to hear a true Dhamma. There are those that listen attentively and those that do not listen attentively. One with a sense of the distinctions of individuals disapproves of those who listen inattentively, and they praise those that do listen attentively. And again, there's plenty of stories of that. The Buddha is just saying, in this context of this sutta, that if you have a sense of the Dhamma, a sense of yourself, a sense of the meaning and purpose, etc., etc., you will now be listening attentively because you understand the importance of what you're listening to. If you're missing any of those senses of the Dhamma or a sense of the meaning and purpose of the Dhamma, you likely won't be listening attentively. You might be there because, you know, your friends are there or something else, or it's a nice cool place to spend the evening, but you won't be listening attentively. That's an important aspect of the Dhamma, isn't it? Furthermore, there are two categories of people who listen attentively to the true Dhamma. There are those that explore the meaning of the Dhamma as they remember the Dhamma, and there are those that do not explore the meaning of the Dhamma as they remember the Dhamma. One with a sense of the distinctions of individuals disapproves of those who do not explore the meaning of the Dhamma, the meaning of the true Dhamma, and praise those that do explore the meaning of the true Dhamma. Furthermore, there are two categories of people who explore the meaning of the true Dhamma. There are those that explore the meaning of the true Dhamma but do not practice the true Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma. And there are those that explore the meaning of the true Dhamma and do practice the true meaning of the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma. A disciple who is one with a sense of the distinctions of individuals disapproves of those that do not practice the true Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma, and they praise those that do practice the true Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma, who themselves have a sense of a Dhamma and a sense of the meaning of the Dhamma. A lot of words to just to get to the point that as a Dhamma develops within us, it does become a very refined practice, doesn't it? And there are ever-deepening levels of Dhamma practice and how we apply it to ourselves. And the Buddha's teaching to be mindful of that as one who has a sense of the Dhamma. We understand our deepening understanding. We understand now that we're able to make distinctions between how we may have practiced in the past and right practice. We understand distinctions between people who are practicing a true Dhamma and those who aren't, at least yet. Is that clear? Is it clear the importance of this teaching?
It sounds very judgmental, which surprised me when I was reading it.
Yes, but it's teaching us to use wise judgment or wise discernment only as it applies to the Dhamma practice. We're not trying to diss people, diminish people in any way, but the Buddha's concern here is about developing his Dhamma to its ultimate conclusion, and that takes great discernment.
Did this sutta occur later in his life?
There's no way of really knowing that. I would just be speculating.
It sounded to me more like as your right view, and all the other aspects of the Eightfold Path become more attuned, because I think we've all experienced this, where all of a sudden something you might have never noticed that your friend said or did, all of a sudden you notice it. And I don't think you're judging them, you're saying, wow, you might even say, gee, I used to chime right in with that,
yep.
Or I used to say things like that, so you're recognizing what's no longer there for you, maybe. But you're not necessarily judging the other person. But you might also, in the future, say that you can't associate with that person anymore because of their view. I didn't read it as judgmental. But.
Yeah, and so that's not a harsh judgment, like there's something wrong with that person.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an it's mindful discernment. A good example would be, when I was involved in Tibetan Buddhism, my root guru was this wonderful man. His name was Kenpo, teacher, Kenpo Karthar Rinpoche, meaning teacher. One of the most wonderful men I've ever met. He teaches something that has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught, even though I shouldn't have said his name. Sorry about that. He is the Western head of this particular branch of Tibetan Buddhism. I don't mean anything in any dismissive way to say that he doesn't teach what the Buddha taught. He is a brilliant scholar in that particular branch of Tibetan Buddhism. And so I don't hold him in any disregard at all In fact, I still think he's one of the most wonderful people I've ever met. But wise discernment shows me eventually that what the Buddha taught is something very different than what he taught. And that, again, that's all that the Buddha's teaching here. He's not teaching to denigrate anyone. Mm-hmm. So it's a good question, because it does sound like, from one point of view, it sounds like a harsh judgment, like we're putting someone down.
Yeah.
But it really just practicing discernment within the framework of the Eightfold Path, seeing things clearly. And that's something that the Buddha taught consistently, that to learn the difference between things and learn the difference between right views and wrong views. And that does take judgment framed by the Eightfold Path. Bonnie?
Well, I kind of can understand what Helen's saying. There's one comment where he, and I can't remember exactly, but it's saying, if you're not listening to the Dharma, that's not okay.
Listening attentively.
Yeah, but it was in the last strand of what you had read, and I can't quite remember, but it felt like if someone isn't studying the Dharma, then they're...
Well,
it's not okay, but if you're studying the Dharma, then that is okay. So,
again, in context,
I know it's relation to the Four Noble Truths, right? But I don't want to get hooked into that, because I feel like there are plenty of times when I can't listen. I fall away. I try to listen attentively and I can't pay attention because whatever's going on, I get distracted.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm lost. I don't know what I'm saying now. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I'm following you. It is. It's an important point. Again, and you said, in the context of the Dhamma, if you want to understand the Dhamma, you have to listen attentively. That's all the Buddha's saying. And if you don't, you might have one who has all these other qualities, but if you can't listen attentively, you're not going to get the Dhamma. It's not, if you don't listen attentively, you're a dirtbag. You know?
But it's also hard, as when you practice, to always be listening. I mean, I try, but there are times when...
Yeah.
There's a lot of noise.
But you'll know
and
that.
Yes, and it's important to recognize that.
You'll know that because you're not on the middle way. So you know when you're not practicing properly.
Right.
You know when you're not putting the time in properly because you're not on the equal path.
Yes, and it's important that you know it. And again, the Buddha's not saying if you realize in yourself that you're not being attentive, listening attentively, to go beat yourself up for a while and then come back to the Dhamma. He's simply saying to be mindful of it, just like you're expressing, Bonnie, that you understand that in this moment I'm not listening attentively. The Buddha recognized that too. And he said to be mindful of it, and when you're not listening attentively, to listen attentively. Again, it's just a framework a description of one who is developing the Dhamma to its most subtle and powerful levels.
And isn't it also underscoring that this is a journey, and an inside job? It's really not about things external to us, right?
Yes.
That this is, and it sounds like you just said this, that this is about ourselves and our behaviors as outlined in this particular sutta.
Yes.
You may, we live in a phenomenal world. It's not really about other people, not just in this sutta, but all of this work isn't really about other people. Like you often say, someone might not even notice that you're doing this work.
Yeah.
That's not the goal, that this is external. It's internal.
Yep. Yeah, and it's just that. So none of us would... There's nothing in this teaching that would say, go find people that aren't listening attentively and tell them. It's got nothing to do with it. In fact, that would be an act of wrong speech, wouldn't it, and wrong action. The Buddha's just teaching discernment between very subtle levels of Dhamma practice. Does that help, Helen? It was a great question because I think it needed to be.
I just thought that the word disapproves was in there.
Oh, well, you know, that's obviously translated from the Pali. And I think
it just started to sound elitist and like a religion to me.
Yeah.
Like if you're not with us, you're against us, that kind of thing.
Well, it is.
And I mean, I certainly, after all these years, do understand that so much of this journey is peeling the onion, going through the layers of discernment and the very subtle levels that bring you to closer and closer to the middle way. So that part, you know, that's clear to me. Just the language this time sounded more elitist to me, which I was surprised about.
Yeah, I'm as you were talking, I'm trying to think of a more appropriate word that would make the point, because we're not talking about...
Because it's not saying if you're not listening attentively, you're not getting full benefit. I mean, that's how I would have expected it to be explained, not like... If you're not listening attentively, then you're not with us, or you're not doing it, or you're not one of us. It's kind of how it came across, and just kind of been the way I was hearing it.
Yeah. No, I understand exactly what you're saying. Remember that the point of view is how your Dhamma practice is, and he's using an example of an amorphous example of one who is not practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would disapprove of that type of practice and approve of someone who is listening attentively. I guess you could pick other words that didn't have a charge to them. But again, there's nothing...
It could be semantics.
Well, it is, but it's also an important point.
It just seemed like that to use that language had to be very intentional.
Oh, I think it was. I think Tanasera used it, and I didn't. I mean, there's sometimes I change Tanasera's words to better fit what I think is more appropriate. But I left the words in because I think that they are.
No, yeah,
I approve
no,
of them.
The words. I'm going to chew on them.
Yeah,
the judgment and the disapproval is always really pointed towards your own practice. If you find somebody who you see doing something. The judgment is not so much that they are wrong, it's that it doesn't do my practice any good to associate with them. It always points, the judgment points back to your own practice.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not that this another person is in any way anything other than a person.
Yeah, they are what they are.
It's as far as my understanding of the Dhamma practice is. That's the point. That's the point of everything the Buddha teaches. You know, he does continue to make a distinction between what he teaches and what other people taught and what other people do, because it's important. It's not, you know, we all know the Eightfold Path isn't something that, you know, it's not a sixfold path, it's not a 20-fold path. It is this. And it is most successfully and efficiently developed by staying focused on it. And that's what this Sutta is about, what it looks like to have a well-focused Dhamma practice.
And Jen once said that she had the experience of recognizing her own, and I forget how she said it, but like her own BS, like, you know, her own, like, oh, I think I'm doing okay, or I think I'm giving right effort, and then becoming aware that maybe you're not. Right,
yeah.
And so it's calling yourself on that kind of behavior, and maybe this doesn't relate, but it was realizing when your practice or whatever component of the Eightfold Path isn't what it needs to be, recognizing that, and not just letting that go, like holding yourself accountable.
Yeah, and not taking any of that personal, including judging another person from a personal standpoint. In other words, I got the Dhamma, they don't. There's something wrong with them. That would be a harsh judgment. It's simply using the framework of the Dhamma to recognize that you're developing the Dhamma the way it's meant to be developed.
This seemed very, the structure of this seemed like a building of a rule book of this growing sangha, possibly an unruly portions of the sangha, and he's teaching them how to act in certain situations and be aware of your time and be aware of your practice. Because, and it doesn't put it in context. Like, a lot of times it says, hey, he's at this grove, and you know, he's talking to these people.
There's something about the setting that makes this one different, I think.
But it just seems like an instruction book, a rule book, that is growing, because it's not just the Four Noble Truths, and it just seems like it's trying to put structure.
I'm sorry.
When I read this, I read it, you know, we have the Eightfold Path, the word. I read it as a path to the construction of how to follow the Dharma. It's the pathway, and I think that's what he's talking about, that you're on the path. If you can identify with what he's talking about in the correct way, you're on the path.
Yeah.
And I that's how I read it. I didn't read it as a negative to people that are not on the path. I read it as a positive, that you're on the path, you're on the right way that the Buddha was thinking and teaching, that there's a pathway for you. That's how I read this sutta.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to see it. The Buddha's teaching what it looks like.
Yeah.
You know, Dhamma Nu Sutta means one with a sense of the Dhamma. It's not one who doesn't have a sense of the Dhamma in, you know, in a personal way. This is what a Dhamma practice looks like at ever more refined levels of practice. You know? And so there is distinctions between someone who's not doing that and someone who is. It doesn't mean, there's nothing in the Buddhist teachings that ever said that the those that don't develop the Dhamma the way he says the Dhamma should be practiced are bad or wrong or gonna burn in hell or anything. But there's a distinction between people. And this is the last part of the sutta, is to notice those distinctions. One of the things that, you've heard me say that the Buddha was one of the most courageous and brilliant thinkers I've ever come across. The reason why I say that is, most of the spiritual teachers during his time and most of the spiritual teachers of this time want to teach an all-encompassing, everything's reconcilable into this, whatever this is, to gather as many people as they possibly can. The Buddha recognized the incredible cruelty of doing that, and he refused to do it from the first day he started teaching. And from the first day he started teaching, he said, this is what it is, and this is what it isn't. Why? So people could make a clear distinction, a clear decision about what they wanted to do. And from the point of view of a Buddhist teaching, the choice is whether you want to continue ignorance or not. To other people that have no understanding of the Dhamma, it's no choice at all, isn't it? You just continue to go along with what you believe in. And the Buddha leaves them all in peace. He's only concerned, every sutta, every word the Buddha ever taught, his only concern was teaching people that wanted to learn his Dhamma. The people that didn't want to learn the Dhamma, he had different answers for, such as Vachagoda, your questions are confusing you. And he left him to go on his way. He didn't manipulate him in any way or try to convince him that he had the one all-encompassing truth. He just said, this is my Dhamma. If you want it, fine. If you don't, you know. So he was as impersonal about his Dhamma as he was about the people that studied his Dhamma with him, or at least he tried to teach that. So it's really not a matter of, you know, it's not a matter of judging other people that aren't engaged in the Dhamma the way the Buddha taught the Dhamma in a harsh way, but it is about recognizing the distinction between the sutta, between someone who's practicing the Dhamma, who is one with the sense of the Dhamma, and those that aren't. So
and
what a great discussion.
The way it's formulated, also you have to remember, he was saying this so that it would be memorized. That's why it's so cut and dry. What David was saying, this is probably the beginning of a rule book. This is supposed to be memorized. And that it gives it a different flavor than if you're just telling my story. He probably saw the need to hammer this down. You know, there's so many people going off in wrong directions. Let's just lay this down. This is how it's done.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there was enough, there was a strong enough foundation within the Sangha, within the community, that they could understand this too.
There were enough people that were in the Dhamma and well versed.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, if this was a sutta, if this was his first sutta, there'd be no Buddha, would there? Because there's no frame of reference, there's no context for it. But again, within a growing, again, there's no way of knowing. I would bet it might be relatively early in the Buddha's teaching career, but again, there's no way of knowing. But there was an established Sangha, and the Buddha recognized the importance of pointing out a refined Dhamma. And he also, people have come and gone in the Sangha at that point. Some practice the Dhamma immediately. Sariputta and Moggallana come to mind. They immediately took to the Dhamma. And there are those that struggled off and on for years because maybe this one wasn't listening attentively. They had all the other aspects of the Dhamma, but they just didn't listen attentively. So he noticed that, and he made it part of a sermon, if you will, use that word. He noticed the difficulties that some people had in developing the Dhamma, and out of this great compassion, he taught something like this. He taught how to know the difference. How to know the difference between individuals and how to know the difference between an authentic Dhamma practice that's likely to develop awakening and a Dhamma practice that I'm missing something in. And so here's the Dhammanusutta. Boy, what a great question you asked. It led to a great discussion. All right, let's see if we'll finish. Furthermore, there are two categories of people who practice the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma. There are those that practice solely for their own benefit and those that practice for their own benefit and for the benefit of others. A disciple is one with a sense of the distinctions of individuals, disapproves of those practicing the Dhamma solely for their own benefit, and they praise those who practice my Dhamma for their own benefit and for the benefit of others. So using the word in this context, I guess, is a little bit softer, isn't it? Because it's directly in the context of practicing the Dhamma. But it's the same thing. We're just recognizing what's a skillful Dhamma practice and what isn't. The Buddha continues, knowing these distinctions among people, this disciple is one with a sense of the distinctions among people. A disciple who is worthy of support and recognition has these seven qualities. That's the end of the sutta. We made it through. Thank you. That discussion we had was really, thank you, Helen, for leading it off. Because it's something that kind of underlies the Dhamma, isn't it? It is, at times, very specific about what it is and what it isn't. And it can be seen, I'll use your word, Helen, it can be seen as elitist until you understand in a much greater context who the Buddha was, how he lived his life, and how the men and women of the original Sangha lived their lives. They were the antithesis of elite, weren't they? They clothed themselves in rags, even though very quickly the Buddha could have been wearing the most beautiful robes and jewelry and perfumes and everything else, because he got almost immediate recognition. To his dying day, he wore robes made of rags. He ate one bowl of donated food a day. He slept on the ground for the most part. And all of those around him did exactly like that. For 45 years, he eschewed, how's that for a word, any kind of acknowledgement other than what he was, which was a Tathagata, an awakened human being. And he more or less insisted by example that people follow him, act in the same way. It wasn't a false type of humility. It was a humility born of understanding. It was a humility born of moderation, born of restraint. Mahakasapa, who was one of the great monks during the Buddha's time, lived almost his entire life even further removed from the Sangha than the Sangha was. So the Sangha lived separated from the world so they could be disentangled. And Mahakasapa spent most of his life in the woods, even separated from that, because he preferred that. Those that develop the Dhamma as the Dhamma is meant to be are the most ordinary human beings. We are the most ordinary human beings we could possibly be, because we're doing nothing special except awakening. The Buddha taught his Dhamma that way. He taught it for human beings. He didn't teach it for any type of elite class, even during that time. And that took a lot of courage 2,600 years ago. Because 2,600 years ago, ordinary people weren't allowed to hear anything spiritual, especially if you were one of the untouchable class. It was punishable by death if you would teach anything spiritual to these people. Never stopped the Buddha. The Buddha taught anyone that was interested, from the lowest untouchable to the person with the greatest power. Didn't matter to him. And the Buddha never held himself out as anything other than an awakened human being. And if you wanted to teach it, he said, Ehepasiko, come and see for yourself. And that's kind of the point of this. Any questions? We'll go around the room. Frank.
Not a question, just good to see everybody.
Good to have you back.
I'm going to be splitting early tonight. The rain and the weather. I'm going to get up early. So.
Glad you made it.
And I don't really have a lot to say on the sutta, because the only thing that I heard attentively was that the Buddha's Dhamma can be developed internally, and that's all I needed to hear, because that's where I feel like I'm at. You know, I feel like I'm on that path of developing an internal Dhamma every day. From the time I get up, just getting back from 4 weeks vacation, and I had some really great experiences on Nantucket, and what a complete turnaround from what it used to be for me. I used to be all about the whole hustle and bustle and going out to dinner and, you know, being in the mix of everybody. And this year, it was a complete different experience of being away from town, being out on the cliff, overlooking the ocean. And every time I went to town with my family, I was a part of it, but I wasn't entangled in it or anything. It was more like I was an observer, and it wasn't like I was judging anybody, but I felt a total peace back on the cliff. And in the morning I go out with my coffee, and the rabbits didn't seem to mind that I was there, or the deer or the birds or nothing. I was just sitting there, and they're like, I felt like I was it was just weird.
Cinderella.
Yeah, whatever. That was the ark. I thought there was a flood or something. The Holy Adams were coming on the ark. I was like, what's going on here?
St. Francis, sorry.
It's good to have you back. It sounds like you're one with a sense of the Dhamma.
So, yeah, I just, you know, I like to keep it simple. Anyway, good to see everybody.
Good to see you, Frank.
You're feeling better?
I'm a little tired tonight. Anyway, safe travels, everybody.
Yeah, get home safe. Right. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. So, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Take care, Frank. Good to see you. Russ, how are you tonight? Might as well go from the back.
Good. There. I'm just happy to be here listening and learning. That's about it.
I'm glad you're here. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, too. It's really good to be here. I miss you.
We missed you.
I was away, and then was dealing with my hand. So it's good to be here. That's all I have to say.
Glad you're here. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you. I've been here. Just going to keep listening. You know, it's... Yeah.
Glad you're here. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Thank you.
you.
Thank you for starting a great discussion.
yeah, I think I've said what I wanted to say. So thank you.
Glad you're here. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. I thought this was a good sutta, you know. It's a little bit like, you know, tips for living in the real world. Ways to, like, you can do this in some level of seclusion or make it very private just to yourself and kind of live in the real world, but this was really addressing living in the real world.
Yeah.
And where there might be gaps, and I guess I look at it as, like, what is really the path of the Dhamma and what is sort of the path of the Dhamma, and keeping track of yourself, keeping yourself honest and true, and the active engagement that it takes to live this in the real world. When you think about some of the situations that were addressed in the sutta, like, it almost sounded like if you were going to be in social gatherings, how you might need to prepare to be in the social gathering.
Yeah.
Right? Not something I would normally think about, how to prepare to be in that social gathering. But living on the Eightfold Path, how might I prepare going into that social gathering?
Yeah.
Or even how might I prepare knowing the people that are going to be there? Or, I mean, you can even think of family event. I'm going through a family event. How can I prepare to live the integrated life and the Eightfold Path in that environment, knowing what I know, that there are gaps and shortfalls all around you, and maybe in your own practice, right? Because it could be something that triggers you or pulls you off the path or whatever. I don't know, I just thought of it as very practical guidance for living in the real world. So I got off of that.
Thank you for that. It's a great insight that I don't know that I even saw that. That the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path, the practice itself, is mindful preparation for all of life's social interactions, isn't it? And to go in with that, with right view, with a developed right view, and to know how to apply it. Thank you. That was great. David, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. I don't have a lot to say. It just seems like a sutta like this, it's like the next book. Like, the Eightfold Path wasn't enough. We have to flesh it out a little bit more.
Right.
And I like to keep it simple and distill it back to the simplest form, which is the clearest form, where, like tonight, we had confusion about words when the Eightfold Path can't be any clearer. And the Four Noble Truths can't be any clearer than what that says. So, it just, again, I just think that this was his attempt to try to keep all these different views from getting into the teachings.
Yeah, and to reinforce that this is what a Dhamma practice integrated with the Eightfold Path looks like at very refined levels.
And when it doesn't.
And when it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Important to understand that. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you. Got through it in one night.
Yes. I enjoyed it very much. And all the saga discussion, I thought, was tremendous. As I say, I read it and saw a path for myself through it. But you can also say that you maybe don't fit all the links in the path. For instance, when he, right at the end of the sutta, I think it's the last one, that he said that, why are you developing the Dharma? Is it for your own self, or is it for the community, seeing yourself in the community? To be honest, I identify myself with developing it for myself. So I kind of miss that link in the program. So maybe I could learn from this teaching tonight that I should broaden and have more, be more aware of developing it for the benefit of the community. So I've learned something sort of directly to my practice from hearing this sutta. Is that what you mean?
I do, and that's exactly why the Buddha taught the sutta, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so it's really a matter of recognizing, in your case, what benefit you do bring to your sangha. Because you know,
mm-hmm.
we all get a lot out of what you say, it's just as we get out of each other. And even people online have said, oh, Lorna said this. And so that is, it's really just a matter of recognizing that you're developing the Dhamma, not just for your own benefit. But that's, it also speaks to the importance of a well-focused sangha. That's, how else would we do it? Would we develop the Dhamma for the benefit of others? I mean, it's immediately apparent in a well-focused sangha.
And can I just go on to say?
Sure.
Read the sutta, and I was obviously identifying with the thoughts of the Buddha, and I was like ticking that box, I'm in that box, and ticking that box, and ticking that box, and what was I doing? I'm making. You know, I was like, I do that. I know that. And I didn't just read it with the understanding that I'm understanding the Buddha and the teachings, and just keeping that in a, not in an eye-making sense, but in just in a educational sort of sense.
Yeah.
You know, I've been educated down the path that the Buddha's talking through your teachings. I've been educated the right way. And just understanding the education, that would have been okay. But I took it a lot, way more than that. And I do this, I do that. And then I realized, you know, when I'd read it and thought about it, I thought, oh my, you know, so I just wanted to add that. So,
thank you, and it's important that you recognize that.
Yeah.
But it's also important that we recognize that we're learning, that this is working. You know, that there's no eye making in recognizing that you are developing the Dhamma the way it's meant to be. The Buddha talks about it. Again, there's some pretty fine distinctions that are often difficult in the beginning between eye making and just simple recognition, but you know, you can't get too caught up in it. The solution to all of that is to continue to practice.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Ron, good to see you tonight.
I'm really glad to be here today. It's just so great. You know, the suit itself, and when I usually read through it, it's like another laundry list. And you know, and then you kind of put the meat on it, and then the sangha comes in here, and we're just, you know, turning it into this learning experience.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
It's just wonderful. I wouldn't know what else to do in my life, but there's just so much meaning in studying the Dhamma.
As part of a sangha, though, this would be an incredibly dry teaching without all of us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd probably be unbearable.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, but whenever I go online and go into the discussion forums and all that, you know, in the end, all you see is either some authority spewing things down, or this massive confusion.
Yeah.
And not here.
Yeah, it is. It's a well-focused song. It's surprising, some of the... I just came across something. Talk about it. Related to how useful psychedelics are to Buddhist practice. So I was thinking next week we'll all just drop a little acid and maybe do some mushrooms.
I might be busy next week.
This was a serious article.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's starting to be recognized for the potential for PTSD and other things. So it's
mental
illness. It's topical right now that people are talking about it again.
Yeah. Yeah, but that doesn't make it Buddha. And it was topical, by the way, 30 years ago.
Right.
How are you?
That's a whole different path.
I tried it. It wasn't here. Great class tonight. Any other questions or comments about this? All right. We'll finish with... I don't think I have any announcements. We'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes. And gently close your mouth. And give me a moment to bring it up. I should know it by heart. I probably do, but... So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. And gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.